You are listening to episode 9 of season 9 of the GNU World Order, the New Zealand edition. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu and this is the GNU World Order. On this show we talk about geeky topics of all sorts, primarily centering around Linux and Unix and, well, Python lately. If you are new to the show or you've been away from the show for a while, you may not know this, but I'm not really usually in New Zealand. I'm not from New Zealand, you can probably tell from the way I speak. But lately, yes, I've been in New Zealand. I actually, very recently, got hired by a company in New Zealand. And it's an exciting thing for me because, for a lot of different reasons, but the main reason, I guess, is because it's really the first time that I've been hired for the requisite combination of my Linux and my multimedia knowledge. So it's a unique position in that sense. And I mean, I've been hired by companies before to do things because I've known Linux or because I've known multimedia, but it's never been a conjunction of those two things that has been the appeal. But this job specifically needed someone who knew Linux and multimedia, so it's really, really exciting and great to be here, and I'll probably give you random updates and insights about New Zealand periodically for, well, probably the rest of the season. In that line of thought, actually, there is something that I wanted to bring up and kind of review, which is Linux as the sole operating system in the workplace, or in really any environment. It wouldn't have to be the workplace, but in this case, I guess specifically the workplace. Where I work is a multimedia production place, do lots of media work, and it's really basically entirely a Linux shop, which has been fantastic. I mean, to go to work, to sit down in front of a KDE desktop that's running Linux, working on that desktop, running Linux, doing, you know, shell and Python stuff for work, it's been very cool. It's been a lot of fun. It's given me a lot of insight in how Linux, as the solitary operating system in the workplace, it really ought to be done. That has been something that, I mean, for me, at my last position, my last job, of course, I was the sysadmin, but unfortunately I never got the place that I worked at entirely on Linux. That was not something that I was able to achieve myself before being whisked away to New Zealand. So I never really had a chance to set things up the way they ought to be set up. And I did a lot of what I would think was due diligence and investigating, you know, okay, how is a professional network supposed to be set up? How are things supposed to be working? You know, what's the workflow supposed to be like? And unfortunately, I didn't get a whole lot of support from my employers at the time in terms of implementing standards, you know, just through the workplace, just implementing things need to be done this way or that way in order to be supported by, you know, this company's IT department, in other words, me. So I never really made that much progress, unfortunately, in that sense. And that was one of the things as a sysadmin I really did want to get to. I wanted to get to that place where we're doing things the correct way and the way that made sense was the way that they were done, and get a system in there that served that purpose. I mean, that is, after all, the strength of Linux, right? It is to, you know, it is the ability to more or less custom design the way things work. I mean, whether you're literally writing your own program or, you know, your own software, or whether you're simply taking the software that has been written but, you know, doing crazy things to its config files and kind of like making it work that way. However that's manifesting itself, that's one of the selling points of Linux for users and for administrators and for management and everything. So I never, unfortunately, got to really experience that, I don't think. Well, I know. I never really got there. Wanted to do a lot more of that. Wasn't really able to. And that's okay, because I feel like I learned a lot anyway at that job and got a lot of great things done, and certainly laid the groundwork, and my replacement is a fervent free software advocate. He's actually the chairman of the local Linux user group. So, you know, I left the place in great hands, and already I've heard about a lot of significant pro free software changes that have been happening there. So sometimes it happens in stages, and I think that's important for us all as free software advocates to realize that, you know, you may not be the one to quote unquote close the deal or close the sale or whatever that expression is where you are, a salesperson and you're closing the deal. That you're not always the one to do that. Sometimes you are the schmuck that's going out there and laying the groundwork. You're just doing the foundation, and unfortunately, you may not live to see the full realization of your dream, the dream that you had for whatever place we're talking about. And sometimes that's just how it is, and that's okay. So that's one thing. But the other thing that I wanted to say was that there was I had a friend online mostly at some technical conferences as well. I'm not going to say his name because he's not here to defend himself. But in a sense, he said a lot of things actually that at the time when he was saying them, I didn't have the experience, good or bad, to sort of argue the points with him. And to be honest, I kind of just agreed with what he had to say because that was sort of, you know, how could you argue? I really didn't have the experience. And one of the things that he said was that LDAP was simply no match for Active Directory. And in my mind, I really thought that sounded wrong. I just thought, you know, I mean, I just know that places are using LDAP. I know that they've implemented it. It's working for them. I was a little bit surprised to hear that LDAP, you know, didn't have the things that Active Directory had. Now, I've never used, still to this day, never actually used Active Directory, either as a user or an administrator. So I still don't know for sure. You know, I couldn't do a bullet list of feature for feature kind of comparison. But one thing I've learned as a free software kind of guy for, what, 9 seasons of GNU World Order now? Well, 8. One thing I've learned is that bullet point feature by feature comparison is basically useless. And I'm not saying that to say, oh, you know, you can't compare free software with proprietary software. It's just not, you know, that's not what I'm saying. I'm literally saying bullet point comparisons of software, whether it's free versus proprietary or free versus free or whatever, it just doesn't matter. The bullet point per bullet point list simply, it's not, who does that serve? Does it serve the software programmers? Maybe that would probably be the one group that I could kind of see it being helpful for, because that would be basically you'd be giving them a sort of a feature list of, you know, this is what you've got and this is what they have, and I would like everything on column B, and, you know, I either like or don't like the things in column A, so maybe that would serve them in some way. But users and administrators and salespeople and all that, it just really doesn't matter, you know, feature for feature comparisons, because software is different. It works different. It feels different from each other. It's got different interfaces. It serves different markets. People can adapt. You know, it really doesn't make a difference when you're sitting there comparing things, because for every perceived pro, there's going to be inevitably a perceived con. And even if there's not, I mean, for every perceived pro, there's someone else saying, no, that's actually a perceived con. If someone is out there saying, no, actually that's a killer feature, I love that, don't you dare touch it. So it really doesn't matter. So I don't feel like I really need to sit down and compare LDAP or free IPA or, what is it, 389. I don't feel like that's something that you need to sit down and compare to Active Directory on a blow-by-blow basis. What I will say is that end results are phenomenal. I'm now working in a place that has a serious deployment of LDAP. I'm talking serious deployment. I'm talking spreading multiple buildings, thousands, I guess I should say hundreds, past 1,000 users using this setup, and it works fantastic. I mean, I'm talking network drives. I'm talking about shared storage, local storage, LDAP, authentication, unified authentication across different platforms, email contact lists, internal mailing lists, but also Jabber, just everything that you can think of for that kind of, what a network should be. This place has it, and it's fantastic, and it's phenomenal, and it is just, it's staggering how well designed it all is. And this was just designed by people like you and me, maybe not exactly like you and me, maybe lots of more years of experience doing this stuff, but it's just regular people taking software by regular people, free software, and designing it and implementing it intelligently in such a way that it serves the needs of its users. And it's really, really, really nice. I've seen enough of LDAP, of Active Directory and things like that, to know what it's supposed to do, the functions that it provides. I'm aware of those concepts, networked application, software, centralized licensing servers, just everything that you can think, internal DNS, internal proxies, just everything. Well, proxies wouldn't be a function of LDAP, but yeah, I mean, it's a well-designed network, and I'm officially, absolutely, unequivocally sitting here saying that LDAP is everything that you imagine it is. So if there's any doubt in your mind because some fancy, sysadmin with a Microsoft polo shirt on says, that just doesn't compare to Active Directory, it just doesn't have the features or doesn't have the whatever, it's wrong. It's just dead wrong. They may not know how to implement those features. They may not have the ability to implement them for one reason or for another, but it doesn't mean that LDAP doesn't have it or some software, that would relate to LDAP can be plugged in to have some, feature. It's incorrect, absolutely incorrect to say that LDAP and related software cannot match, an enterprise level kind of infrastructure. It's absurd. I'm actually a little bit surprised at myself for even thinking that might be the case. But like I say, I really didn't have the experience one way or the other, and just kind of glossed over it. I won't say that I took it at face value, because I don't know that I ever actually thought, wow, too bad, LDAP sucks. I never really thought that. But in terms of having, confidence in LDAP, I didn't, because again, I hadn't really used it that much, but now I've used it. I'm a happy user of it. I am absolutely sold on free software infrastructure design. It works very well. It's amazing, actually. And just the level of customization that you have is, well, exactly what you would think. I mean, again, like I said at the beginning, Linux, free software, one of the selling points of it, obviously, is the configurability of it. And that's what we have at this place that I work at. Very specific needs that, I mean, frankly, off-the-shelf software just wouldn't even exist for some of this stuff, and doesn't exist for this stuff. and yet it exists. And that is, I mean, every day I go to work and think that thought, and that's an amazing feeling. So, yes, very happy to be working in and around and on and with Linux. It's fantastic. But enough about me. Now it's time to switch over to listener. I knew it started with an L. Listener feedback. And the feedback that I really wanted to talk about, well, two feedbacks, I guess. First of all, you should go check out nomediakings.net. This isn't actually feedback, but it's something interesting. It was in my inbox. So nomediakings.net. I think it was Lost in Bronx, or maybe it was Deep Geek, or maybe it was me. I don't remember. Someone found this movie called Invest Wisely, and it's a sci-fi movie, super independent, just really, really low budget, made on, you know, cheap digital cameras by 7 different directors. It was, I think, originally a web series, and then they kind of cut it all together in a movie, which is tied together in sort of a kind of a common thread, common themes, and it ends up basically having a story, some reoccurring characters, but it is a very good movie. I highly recommend it. Go view it, and then listen to me and Lost in Bronx and Deep Geek, and I think Sigflup and maybe Scarlet talk about this movie on maybe Hacker Public Radio, or maybe it was Information Underground. I don't know. But it's definitely worth checking out. Turns out, a little while later, I found out that the publisher of that movie is this place called No Media Kings, and the guy who runs No Media Kings, I mean, I imagine it's probably just him anyway, is named Jim, and so I emailed him at one point to see if he could visit. I think this is why I emailed him. I emailed him later because I found out that he had also written this comic, this graphic novel that I'd really enjoyed called Repent, maybe? Yeah, I think it was called Repent or something like that. It's about, like, this weird post-apocalyptic slash post, rapture thing. And there are these angels, and there's this talking dog, and it's really crazy, and you should check that out as well, graphic novel. So the guy, this the same guy, had done both things. So I emailed him just sort of to say hi, just, hey, I realized that you've made 2 of my favorite artworks, and I wanted to say hi. Turns out he is an Ubuntu user. He's a Linux user himself. So that obvious, and an anarchist. So that obviously, like, I'm crazy about this guy now. So he's got this new project. It's he's got a trailer out for a near future video game subculture movie. I don't know what it's going to become or how far along it is, but you should go check it out. Haphead.com. HAPHEAD.com. Go check it out. Support this guy. His stuff is amazing. Go get his video, go get his graphic novel. I can't promise you, but I feel fairly confident in assuring you that you will not be disappointed. So that was that. Now, the other feedback that I got that I wanted to mention was from Doug, your friend and mine, Doug. He's the Python guy. He was the one who kept bugging me to get more Python on the show, which essentially turned out to be season 9, as it is looking now. So he says, you know, thanks for telling him about Sphinx. Sphinx was the thing that I mentioned, I guess, in the last episode. I don't really remember. About the Python. It's kind of a documentation markdown system that has a Python backend, and I have to say, it is both simultaneously as easy and as difficult as one could ever want a documentation system to be. Meaning that it's really, really easy until you start getting into the weird Python tab issues, which, if you think they're hard when you're doing code, try to make them work when you're just writing text. It really does start to get confusing. But either way, it does, it It doesn't require a knowledge of XML. It does not require a docbook setup. All you have to do is write with a simple, simple markdown, and then Python takes care of all the rest. I'm talking web page, PDF, EPUB, just everything you could, every format that you could want to output to. It just kind of happens for you. It's really, really nice. Okay, so Doug thanked me for that. I'm sure you do too. But he also says that he wants to clarify what the self concept of object-oriented programming is. And this is great. So he says Python is a little bit weird in how the syntax of self works in the language. All methods, that is, functions, defined as part of a class are required to have self as the first parameter in the method definition. However, when calling the method, you don't include self as part of the call. Strange, but what the heck, I've gotten over it. A class in Python is a definition of an object you can create in Python, which I think we covered pretty well in the dice example. That was me interjecting that. So back to what he's saying. A class in Python is a definition of an object you can create in Python, but not an actual instance of that class. You might have read stuff where people describe this as a cookie cutter mold, and the instances are the cookies. This description has never really helped me understand what an instance actually is. The way I understand it is the class definition defines all the code that is shared by all instances of a class, and self identifies the particular instance and its variables or attributes. I've written a small Python program that I hope illustrates this. And then he's got a little sample Python program that I will obviously have on, you know, a link to on the website, and I will probably add it somewhere online so that it gets preserved forever and give him credit for it. And frankly, you should check that program out, which I'll have online. But, I mean, honestly, I think that his description is really, really brilliant. So he says, again, just to repeat, the way I understand it is, the class definition defines all the code that is shared by all instances of the class, and self identifies the particular instance and its variables. So that kind of, it really does. I mean, if you think about the term self, it does make sense, right? Because, I mean, that is, we're all humans. Well, some of us are anyway. But the thing that makes us unique is, you know, when we're thinking about ourselves is, I am myself. So that tends to make sense to me. And it's good. It's a good thing to understand. And it's a great email from Doug. Thank you, as always, Doug, for the clarification and the elucidation or illumination. I think that's really, really helpful. And we should probably get into Python programming now that we are on the topic. Or then again, I guess we could take a coffee break, because that is, of course, what that music means. So go get yourself a great cup of coffee. Fill it up to the brim, and come on back, and we'll finish up the show. You know, actually, now that I have this steaming cup of coffee that looks and smells and tastes so good, I don't want to jump right into Python right now, because, I mean, we're drinking, and Python requires typing. So let's pause for a minute, and I want to actually kind of discuss the coffee culture of New Zealand and how it differs from the coffee culture of America, because this is important information that I don't really see being covered in any other podcast, strangely. I think it's an important topic. I don't know why other people aren't covering it, but that's why you listen to this show, the stuff you don't get elsewhere. So in America, and I'm not going to assume that you are from America yourself, so I'm going to tell you both cultures. So in the USA, I should say, not just America, in the USA specifically, and I can't speak necessarily for Mexico or Canada or South America at all, because I just don't know. But in the USA specifically, coffee culture is I would say fairly broad, and I guess I don't think many people would disagree with me that, you know, in the sense of slumming it versus living the high life, the bottom of the rung is diner coffee, and people who have been to the USA to a really proper, you know, all-night diner or something like that, they know what I'm talking about. They know what diner coffee is. And certainly, even if we don't call it diner coffee, I mean, that brand, that kind of coffee, the cheaper brands of coffee, which I'm not going to say the names of, but they all have, you know, equally famous commercial jingles that I'm sure you probably know. But that those coffees, very specifically, put through a drip coffee maker. That is, you know, through a paper filter and dripping down onto a glass container that is, or a metal, you know, coffee pot on a heated plate so that you can make, you know, I don't know, 12 cups and then just kind of keep it warm while people come in and out of your diner and you refill their cups and that sort of, that style. Or maybe you put it into a big jug and put it out on, you know, somewhere so that people can help themselves. However you're doing it, you know, and even percolated coffee, that sort of thing, which obviously is dying down now. You can't really find that many places. But that style of coffee, it's a very specific, and I'm gathering that it's a very United States specific kind of coffee, and you just don't get that elsewhere, really. And I kind of knew that, because when I went to France, and when I went to Mexico, you couldn't really find, you know, you didn't get that coffee. You didn't go into restaurants, you didn't go into cafes, you didn't go anywhere and ask for a cup of coffee and get that kind of coffee. And even if you were seeking it out, you didn't get that kind of coffee. And if you insisted upon having that kind of coffee, the closest thing people could offer generally was instant coffee. And that's nowhere near the same thing. Now, above that, obviously, in the U.S., you've got the nicer coffees. You've got places that you can actually go for good coffee. And you've got the franchised kind of places that claim they have nice coffee that don't actually have good coffee. But, there are those different levels. In New Zealand, I am finding... Oh, and by the way, I should mention, right before I left the U.S., right before, like literally probably the week before, I went over to visit a friend of a friend, and she, Louisa, I believe was her name, or Louise, and she was from a time, she grew up a long time before I was even alive, and she had all of these wonderful things in her house, and she kept offering us coffee or you know, something to drink. And so she finally got around and said, how about some coffee? And so obviously I said, oh, well, okay, if you're offering coffee, yes, I will take a cup of coffee. So she takes us back to her kitchen, beautiful kitchen, sits us down at this, you know, this Formica table. She brings out this coffee. I take one sip of it and my life has changed. And I'm just like, what is this? And it was percolated coffee. It was coffee that she had made in a percolator. It was absolutely mind-blowing. If you ever get the chance to get percolated coffee, and I know people are thinking percolated coffee is impure because it keeps boiling over on itself and it's bad and it's... Don't talk to me about purism and coffee, okay? Coffee is beautiful in all of its manifestations, well, except instant. But I mean, yeah, and percolated is just another aspect of this wonderful substance. And it was just fantastic. If you get a chance to have real percolated coffee, grab that chance, because it can be mind-blowing. I mean, it can also be very bad, I'm sure. But try it out, just once, at least. Try it. Okay. So on to New Zealand. So New Zealand, I think I gather much like Europe, although again, I've only been to France in terms of Europe, so I'm not really, and then only for like a week or so. So, but New Zealand, the coffee culture is quite strong, actually. It's I mean, the city where I live is seems to be a little bit famous for their coffee culture. So they've got really, really nice places to get coffee, lots of places to get really good coffee, but all coffee is made in an espresso machine. I mean, that's just how it's done here, which is really interesting to me. And of course, the world famous allowance for the difference between United States coffee culture and everyone else coffee culture is the Americano, right? You can ask, oh, give me an Americano. And an Americano, of course, is a it's an espresso with hot water, boiling water in it, added to it after the espresso is made, thereby rendering the espresso weaker, a lot weaker. And that's an Americano, and I love an Americano. I love that taste, but it is a distinct taste. I mean, the Americano is it's called an Americano from the people who invented it, I'm sure, because it was given to Americans, but it is distinct. I mean, in America you can get an Americano, and you would think, well, why would you get an Americano in America? Don't you just call it coffee there? Well, yeah, we do, but that's not what an Americano is. Americano, it was a nice try, but it doesn't approximate an American cup of coffee. And understand, I'm not giving you national pride here. I'm simply comparing coffee cultures and the different cultures or the different cups of coffee that you will get going to different places. I'm not claiming that, the US has like better coffee or anything like that. I'm saying it has a distinct kind of coffee that I cannot seem to find in New Zealand, which is just interesting to me. I mean, I can find it in my own home, but it's a unique thing. And in New Zealand, you've got interesting things. You've got well, obviously Americanos, but if I'm understanding, and I'm actually still learning it myself, but that's it's actually called a long black. So it's like a it's black coffee, and they call it long, I guess, because they add hot water to it. You could also get a short black, which is just an espresso. But you can get a long black, which is the same amount of espresso, but they fill up the rest of the cup with hot water. You can get a long white, I think, and I don't think you can get a short white. And then you've got other things like lattes and cappuccinos and, the usual assortment of normal, globally recognized coffee. But they really don't have that American sort of diner, drip coffee anywhere, outside, out in the world. And it's kind of interesting, that is, because when you go to a cafe, I mean, you really are kind of going there for, well, I mean, I don't know why you're going there, but if you're going there for coffee, you're going for the cup. You're actually going to experience that cup of coffee, which in the US I'm not exactly used to. I mean, sometimes you just go to the cafe so that you can get like a big, huge cup of just drip coffee and just sip on it all afternoon long. So it's kind of an interesting difference. And even when I'm out in town, and I go and grab a cup of coffee from a cafe or something to go, to take away, I mean, you their large cup of coffee is I don't know, like 8 ounces. I mean, that's what you have. They're little tiny short stubby cups. And that's the Americano version of it. If you don't get the long black, you're really it's just a couple of shots of espresso. So it's really different. And I know the big joke is that Americans like everything really big, and that, I mean, in a lot of ways that is true. I mean, you do have if you go to the US, you'll have people sipping like 20 or 30 ounce cups. It's just huge, huge things for no good reason. But I think the other side of that is that getting away from like, oh, we just like big cups. Part of it is just the no, I just want a hot drink to last for a while. I want that sort of really ultra mellow flavor, and that's the difference between an Americano and a drip cup. I mean, if the Americano still has the harshness of the espresso sort of diluted, but it's still a different texture, not texture, but it's a different distinctly different flavor. Whereas the drip, of course, is more like, I mean, it's like a tea, really, you know? I mean, that's what drip coffee is, right? It's not coffee. It hasn't been, you know, steam hasn't been forced through it, grabbing all the coffee molecules or whatever happens when you make coffee. I'm not a chemist, but a scientist, really. But, you know, the drip, I mean, it's just kind of, it sort of infuses the water with that coffee flavor and continues on down. So it's a real difference. And that's just for your information. That's the differences between the coffees in the USA versus New Zealand. I'm not judging either. I'm not saying one is better than the other or one is worse than the other. I'm simply saying they're different and they're both beautiful. And now that you've probably finished your cup of coffee, let's continue on to Python. Okay, so the programming lesson for this episode is indeed in Python, and you can go to see, you can follow along with me online at straightedgelinux.com, that is straightedgelinux.com/blog. Well, you could just go to straightedgelinux.com, click on the blog icon, and then click on the Python icon, and then click into the programming book, and specifically you're looking for Chapter 11, which is, I think, called, like, Feeding Frenzy Game or something. Something like that. Or no, it's actually Pygame, sorry. So the first portion of that chapter's kind of uninteresting. It talks about IDEs, Integrated Development Environments, which I keep thinking that they're, you know, a lot of times people talking about programming just kind of jump in and, like, start urgently telling you about IDEs. So I don't spend a whole lot of time on it, and yet at the same time, you do kind of recognize that in the real world, if you do program more, you will be exposed to IDEs, and so you might as well start getting the concept of those down sooner than later. So certainly, if you want to try out an IDE, there's ERIC, or maybe it's called ERIC 4 now, and there's SPE, Stani Python Editor, which I think was actually designed primarily for Blender interaction. But it's got, you know, I mean, it's a standalone thing, so don't worry about that. So either of those you can do, but really, I mean, a text editor, right? That's what you need. So in this one, we're gonna jump into this thing called Pygame, which I don't think we've touched on yet. So this is interesting because, I mean, so far we've done shell scripts, we've done, what, two Python things so far, I think? One like Python simple thing, like an ls kind of Python, just to introduce you to the idea of Python. And then, of course, the Python based dice game, where we actually did object oriented dice. So we've done some things with Python, and certainly Python is a powerful thing, but Python alone, like literally alone, I mean, it's not all that interesting. It would be kind of like, I guess, maybe installing a really, really basic, minimal Linux distribution, you know, without a whole bunch of tools on it. And you'd open up the shell and there'd be all the basic normal things like ls and cd and mv and things like that. But then you would go to do more interesting things like, I don't know, let's say rev or cut. And suddenly, you know, those haven't been installed for some reason. So Python is a little, you know, if you think of it that way, Python would be a little bit similar to that. I mean, if you just sit down in front of Python, yeah, you have a bunch of great tools. But the time that it starts to get really interesting and really, really powerful is when you start tapping into other Python libraries that exist. Now, to kind of illustrate what I mean by that, you could actually even go, like, if you look in if you're on your box right now, if you do an ls on /usr/lib or lib64, whatever your distro uses, /python, maybe asterisk, because it kind of depends on what version of Python you're looking at, but let's say Python something, /, and if you do an ls on that, you'll see a bunch of Python little application, or little programs in /usr/lib64. or lib, whatever, slash Python. And from here, there are a lot of things, you know, you would recognize a lot of the things here if you kind of looked hard enough. There are a lot of different things that we take more or less for granted that we can do in Python that come right out of there. Now, obviously, in true modular fashion, you could add stuff to that. I mean, you could certainly add lots and lots more functionality to Python by essentially putting more Python program, more Python scripts in that library folder and start drawing upon those so that you can, you know, do fancy things. For instance, I mean, you could take that silly dice game that we did and you could sort of make it into, essentially make it a library, like a dice library. And then you could put it in, well, you could put it there, you could put it anywhere, and then in your program you could say, okay, import dice.py, or, you know, from dice, import, roll, or whatever. So hopefully you kind of get the idea. What I'm trying to say here is that there are programs that perform certain functions that you can then reuse in your new Python scripts so that you don't have to reinvent the wheel. So these are typically called either, you know, libraries, like Python libraries. Sometimes they're called Python modules. And sometimes they're given even fancier names like frameworks and APIs. Well, APIs are a little bit, well, no, let's call it, let's essentially it's this, it's going to feel the same way. So all of these things give Python a lot of additional functionality that would be a lot more difficult to get out of it without having these things around. So Pygame is one of those things. It's a big set of pre-existing Python tricks that you can just import into Python and start using right out of the box. It's really, really cool. If you go to pygame.org, it's pygame.org, and we're going to look at another one later, much later in this season, called PyCute, which, of course, taps into the whole Qt framework, the GUI framework that KDE is written in, for example. But if you go to pygame.org, you go to the, you know, the, well, kind of look around first, because it really is an interesting place to look at. I think there was one game that I mentioned way back on Linux Cranks, I think, and it's called Ardentryst, Ardentryst. It's like a platformer role-playing game. It's really unique and really cool. You should definitely try it out. And it was written in Pygame. It's a quite complex game, so it's not something that you can sit down and write in a weekend, but it gives you some idea of the complexity that you can get into with Pygame. And there's other games as well. You know, there's lots of other games on the site that will give you some idea of all the different things that you could do. It's quite neat. So, Pygame, what is Pygame? Well, as I said, it's essentially just a bunch of other programs that people have written, very sort of generic functionality. So it's not like you can't, you know, you don't say from Pygame import, you know, solitaire. It's not like that, but there's other things that it can do, like handle sprite generation. And if you're at all familiar with video games, then you know the terminology, you know, sprites are the little characters that you move around on the screen, or the little elements that make up the landscape. And they handle generating a window, you know, in which your game world will appear. That's kind of important. You want a window to pop up when people play, you know, start your game. It taps into OpenGL, which is the video generation software that Linux can use, probably one of the, you know, the easiest one to use. Did I say OpenGL? I meant SDL, actually. Although it does have actually OpenGL stuff that you can do as well, but by default it uses SDL, which again does like graphics, fancy graphic stuff. And lots of different things. So Pygame is a great sort of add-on pack to have for your Python environment. The way that you would install it is probably just going to your repository and saying to, you know, asking to install Pygame. That's generally what you'll be doing, so it's pretty straightforward. You don't have to actually download it off of pygame.org, obviously. But after you install it, if you have a look in that /usr/lib/python, whatever, eventually you'll see, you know, things that are from Pygame. So that's, again, kind of how all that stuff manifests itself, is it puts itself into a path where Python knows where to look for it, and then it can tap into all kinds of interesting things. So on my system, it's specifically in /usr/lib64/python2.7/site-packages/pygame, and then a bunch of little libraries and classes and things like that. So that's where that is, in case you just really, really want to see for yourself. So either way, first of all, let's just get a simple-ish Pygame instance happening, just so you can kind of see what I'm talking about and how it works and what exactly it takes to tap into something like Pygame. And I think you'll be pleased with how really easy and you know, not very threatening it actually is. So for today's lesson, let's just do this in an interactive idle console. So just open up a terminal, type in Python, and you should see the three greater than symbols indicating that, yes, you are now in a Python terminal or console. So do that, and just do the whole, everything we'll do today we'll just do in this, because I want you to see things as they occur. If you are not doing this as I talk, because you are driving or something, I will, don't worry, I will give you sort of cues of what everyone else is seeing in this interactive console. And the first lines, of course, would be the import lines. So once you're at the Python console, we will do importing. So I'm just going to say import Pygame. And that's a lot of stuff, but I'm going to just, since it's a small program right now, we're just going to say import everything, import Pygame. And then from Pygame, .locals import asterisk. So that's from Pygame.locals import asterisk. And then we'll also import sys, although I'm not actually guaranteeing that we're going to use that right now. So those are just your basic imports. Again, they're a little bit heavy-handed, but given that that this is a small application, I'm not really worried about memory footprint right now. So the first thing that we'll do, just again because we can and there's not a whole lot of setup that we need to do right now, is we'll initialize Pygame. So pygame.init --. And that simply kicks Pygame sort of on, as it were. If you don't do that, things will run, but then they will start breaking and not running correctly. So you want to initialize Pygame. That starts it off sort of being aware that you're going to start making calls to it. And then we're going to set up a clock for ourselves. Now, this is something that Pygame handles mostly for us, but we still have to just kind of bring it into our program as a thing. And the reason that we need a clock at all, and we'll go ahead and do it right now while I'm talking. So clock space equals pygame.time dot clock with a capital C. Has to be a capital C because that's what Pygame refers to it as. And then --. So now we've just created something called clock. And of course clock is a manifestation of, or an instance of, pygame.time dot clock with a capital C. And what that does is it sets up a steady tick for our game to follow. And by that I mean, under normal circumstances, the desired effect of running code is to, okay, get through this code as quickly as you possibly can. And generally computers do that relatively quickly. I mean, they at least try to. And certainly with something little like Pygame, where it's generating, you know, a couple of pixels here, a couple of pixels there, not really that big of a deal. It could do you know, these simpler video games, certainly, just in no time whatsoever. So that would be a problem. So we're going to say, well, give us a clock and then make our FPS, FPS equals 15, for instance. You could do it higher, you could do it lower, but I'm going to say 15 because that's kind of a nice conservative average number. So what that'll do later is when we start the clock, when we call the clock to advance, it makes sure that the game is progressing at a known rate, you know, throughout the game. And that's not just to give the game some idea of, you know, how often screen refreshes should happen and things like that, but it'll also come into play when characters are animating and we need to tell the computer, okay, I want you to change to this particular sprite where the legs are, like, you know, together, and then tick again one frame forward and then switch to the one where the legs are starting to come apart to walk, and then click one frame and then switch to the different sprite, you know, things like that. So rather than animating a sprite just as quickly as, you know, as it can, you know, a new sprite every millisecond, it'll very specifically tick, 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 tick. So that's why we're doing that. Okay, so we should create some more variables, and this is kind of important conceptually to just, I like to keep my variables more or less together. There are exceptions to that rule, but generally speaking, like global variables, I like to kind of keep them all together. So my FPS has been declared, my clock has been declared, and then we'll go ahead and declare other things like the color black, for instance. I'm going to call black 26, 26, 26, which, if you know colors in RGB, if you look at like a K color picker or the GIMP color chooser, then you'll have seen these values, RGB. And certainly if you've done CSS and prefer RGB versus, or RGBA versus hex, then you'll know this. But yeah, so the first, second, and third values are RGB respectively. So 26, 26, 26 isn't actually black. It's a dark, very deep gray. But I'm just doing that to be stylistic and more tango-y. And then we'll call blue 57, 103, 189. So that's like not a whole lot of red, a little bit of green, a little bit of blue. And that way we don't get like just a primary blue. You know, we could say 00189, but that would be no red, no green, and all blue. So that'd be very, very blue. And then I like to declare a key color, like a chroma key, in case I need to make a certain color invisible. So we'll say 0, 0, 255. So pure blue is going to be my chroma key color. And then, of course, it's always good, I think, to declare a score value. So score equals 0 right now. And eventually there will be, I'm sure, times where you need to declare things like health points or experience points or things like that. You know, you would declare them here. But we'll keep it simple for now. Okay, so that has created sort of our rough environment. Right now, all we're going to do is we're going to create a game world. We're not going to actually create the characters yet, just because I feel like taking it slow is not a bad thing, so we're taking it slow. So we're just going to skip down, if you're following along online, to 11.3.4, creating the world. Now, this is going to tap into Pygame's ability to generate a new window. So, once again, like with our Bash program, our Bash programs, and our Python dice game, it all happened in the terminal. It was text-based, which is fine, but I'm trying to segue us now into a more GUI-centric environment, because, you know, let's face it, a lot of the stuff that you're going to be doing in real life will be GUI. So, what Pygame will do is handle drawing a new window for us. It'll make the necessary operating system calls to our desktop environment or to our window decorator, and it'll make the call to SDL, and it will say, okay, I want a window to be drawn on the screen, and inside that window, I want the game world to appear. So, we're gonna say window underscore width, and we'll set it to 960, because I've got a high-definition screen. And then we'll say window underscore height equals 720. So I'm doing mine roughly at 720p. HD 720, I guess, is what you would call it. You can give it any value you want. Now we're going to say window underscore area equals, and this is where we're actually calling upon Pygame again. So we say pygame.display.set underscore mode parentheses square bracket window width comma window height. Close the square bracket, close the parentheses. Now, if you're doing this in an interactive terminal at all, like I am, then a window will pop up. It will absolutely just generate itself. If you're scripting this in a text editor, like I am not right now, then obviously nothing will happen until you run the game. But yeah, in the interactive terminal, the window, the Pygame window, just kind of appears, and it's labeled Pygame window, and it's empty, and it's black, and that's all it is, or off black, and that's it. That's that's what we get. Now closing it, on the other hand, is a completely different story, but we'll just leave it open right now because it doesn't really matter. And then if you're scripting this, you can also add, for instance, pygame.display.set underscore caption parentheses and then some string. I'll just put GNU world order, close quote, close parentheses. And again, if you're doing this in an interactive terminal, the title of that window will change to whatever you typed in. So if you put pygame.display.set underscore caption paren quote GNU world order, close quote, close paren, then the title of your little self-generated window will be GNU world order. There are different values for the display, and the display one is, I think, the one that's interesting. So I want to show you this in the Pygame documentation. So if you go back to pygame.org/docs, you will see up at the top of /docs, you'll see buffer proxy, camera, CD-ROM, color, cursors, display, draw, event, examples, font, free type, blah, blah, blah. So click on display, and that takes you to the documentation for the pygame.display module. And it tells you, pygame module to control the display window and the screen. And so it gives you all of the different sort of options that you have whenever you're dealing with a display in Pygame. And this is kind of the interesting stuff to me, because all you need to know, really, is that such a module exists. It's called pygame.display. And then how to control that, all you need to know is everything the docs tell you. It tells you right here, pygame display.quit. Well, that'll quit the thing. Pygame display flip. That sort of refreshes the display. It updates, I guess, is what it would be, but I think of it as refreshing. Pygame.set icon. Pygame.display.set caption. All these different things, and I'm trying to look for the one where we actually defined the width of the window. I'm not seeing that somewhere here. Here it is. Set mode. Set mode is obviously the part where you initialize a window or screen. And the reason that we gave it the window width and window height variables was because we, of course, defined window underscore width and defined window underscore height, which is good practice, right? I mean, if we're saying window underscore area equals pygame.display.set underscore mode, and then we know that it wants the width time width comma height, why write those numbers in ourselves when we can give those numbers, give some variables those numbers, and that way we know where to change the numbers later on if we've got like this really, really long application. So I like to variableize as much as I can, I've heard critique about that, that it's more difficult to read that way, different things like that. But I find that if you make all of your important information a variable, then when you go back and you have to, like, you know, update your game for the HD re-release or whatever you're doing, you know, update your application for something, sometimes it's just a matter of, oh, well, the resolution 800 by 600 is no longer, you know, practical for most people. So let's up this to 960 by 720. And all you've had to do is change two variables and suddenly your whole, you know, the whole game world is expanded. Or maybe you have to change a bunch of variables, but at least they're all grouped together in your variable section. So that's how I do it. It's not necessarily what you have to do. That's how I do it. It makes for a lot more variables. You know, so maybe that's a bad thing in some cases, but for me, that's what I like to do. But it is nice to know where to look, certainly for Pygame, and their documentation is some of the better documentation that I've seen for Python, you know, libraries. A lot of the really fancy ones out there, like PyCute and things like that, they start getting really technical and kind of assuming that you just kind of, oh, well, you're only using this because you're a C++ programmer, and so obviously you would know what the int of the static of the type of the, you know, variable was. Why would we discuss that with you? Whereas Pygame is much more sort of for, you know, hey, you're a programmer and you're using Python. Here's all the information that you need to know to understand this thing, which is quite nice. For instance, if you look on the Pygame's docs again, pygame.display.set_mode. So again, that is what we're using to draw our window on the screen. And it says it initializes a window or screen for display. And it says what it requires, what it takes is set_mode and then paren, resolution equals paren 0, comma 0, close parens, comma flags equals 0, comma depth equals 0, close paren. Now that's actually even in itself over complex for what we just did. What all we gave it were the default values of width, comma height, but we could give it a resolution equals width height, flags equals whatever, depth equals whatever. And you think, yeah, but how do I know what all that stuff means? Well, you keep reading, and it says the function will create a display surface. The arguments passed in are requests for a display type. The actual created display will be the best possible match. Blah, blah, blah. I don't care. Point is, down in the white boxes, it tells you. The flag arguments control which type of display you want. There are several to choose from, and you can even combine multiple types, blah, blah, blah. If you pass zero or no flag argument, then it just defaults to whatever. So there's pygame.fullscreen. There's pygame.doublebuff. There's pygame.hwsurface. There's pygame.opengl. Resizable, no frame. There's all kinds of different sort of variations on this. And then they've got examples and things like that. So that's great as well. But the important thing here to realize is that if you look at the documentation for Pygame, you will find the different modules that it has to offer you, and you can learn how to use those modules in your application. And you can even just kind of play around a lot more intelligently, you know, because you know at least how to call certain things and what it kind of expects, I guess. So that's what that is. The question then that I would have for you is, okay, so especially if you're working in an interactive terminal, how would you then close that window? Well, you would look at your documentation and you would kind of scan through it, and sure enough, you would finally find something called pygame.display.quit. And you might go and look at it and read the documentation, but honestly, it doesn't really say a whole lot. It just says, this will shut down the entire display module. This means the any active displays will be closed. And the example that it gives is quit paren paren. Okay, so we can't just say quit paren paren because, first of all, that would quit Python. And second of all, that's not how we imported everything. We just said import Pygame. So we need to prepend things with pygame.display. And then we issue the command quit paren paren. So pygame.display.quit paren paren would close that window. So the important thing, and that's kind of all we have time to cover, to be honest, right now, in this episode, I think. But the important thing to kind of to take away from this is that Python alone, after you play around with it for so long, it does start to feel a little bit, you know, you kind of start to think, okay, well, what do I do with this now that I can add numbers, I can split strings, I can shift around variables, you know, what good is that? Well, actually, it's good for a lot, like, as I've learned. I mean, you can actually do a lot of interesting things just doing that, but to be honest, to be perfectly honest, the power in it, and I don't think many people would disagree with me here, the real power in it is when you start tapping into these other modules, these other libraries that other people have created, generally speaking, and then you get to do all kinds of cool things. I mean everything from programming games with Python, programming desktop applications or any kind of application with PyCute, or tapping into the very interface or the very in sort of world viewport of Blender. The list goes on. I mean, GIMP filters, you know, just all kinds of cool things that you can do. So getting familiar with that, those actions of saying, I want to write such and such an application, I guess I might as well do it in Python. Now, what do I need to bring in order to make that possible? And sometimes it's a question of, okay, well, I'll just bring in PyCute and use that for my interface generation and for, you know, whatever. Or sometimes you might say, well, let me do PyGTK and I'll bring in the GStreamer stuff and I'll do something like that. And sometimes I'll look up the API for Blender or for whatever. You know, it just depends, but that action of saying, okay, I want to write a program, I'm going to go out and find a Python library, I'm going to look over the notes and documentation of that Python library, and then I'm going to start using it. That's a really, really powerful and exciting thing once you start doing that. That's really, really cool. And that is, of course, I mean, once you've got that down, you're programming for real. I mean, that's real live programming. That's what programmers do, or at least a big chunk of them. You know, the people that aren't just sitting down writing the modules themselves, everyone else is using those modules. They're looking them up, they read up on them, and then they start using them. And it's just sort of that simple, and I say simple meaning hard, but it is that simple. So get into that, to that mindset of being able to fearlessly hunt down Python libraries or Python APIs or modules, reading them over, finding out how to use them in your own Python code, and then playing around with them. So until next episode, play around with Pygame a little bit. I don't know how much you'll be able to do, and usually one of the easiest ways to play around with something like this is in an interactive terminal. You know, get that open, generate yourself a window, and then start playing around with the image module or really, you know, anything, the display module, start kind of shifting your display around or whatever, close it, open it, do whatever you want to do, generate a sprite, I don't know, transform something, you know, play around with that, see what you come up with, if anything, and if you don't come up with anything, that's okay, just get used to the idea of having these extra things that you can import and utilize, and then next time we'll actually put them into action. So, and we'll start slow, obviously, like we've done today. So start with that, get a little bit of practice in, and I will talk to you next time. And actually, before I go, I should probably mention that my online presence has altered. I won't say that it's gone down, but it has altered. So if you were one of the people, the lovely people, that I knew via IRC or Jabber or anything like that, you'll notice that I'm not really around anymore. And that's simply because my new job, it's pretty locked down in terms of the network because there's a lot of, I guess you'd call it classified, I don't know, like information that I'm not allowed to discuss and things that aren't supposed to get outside of that network. So it's pretty tightly locked down. And plus I'm busy at work, I mean. So that's kind of like I'm not really around as much anymore in IRC or Jabber or any place like that. So the place that I am now online obviously GNU World Order is my website still. Straight Edge Linux is a good portal for stuff that I'm doing. Slacker Media is a good place. Lightworking.net is an interesting place. But the place that I am socially, I guess, would be linuxquestions.org, and my username there is notclatu. So look me up on linuxquestions.org. It's where I've been hanging out. I've been answering questions, talking to Frank Bell a little bit. Seen some people on there that I've known, you know, in other places. But that is kind of like, that's my social Linux outlet at this point, I would say, was linuxquestions.org, and it's a great place to be, a great place to meet new people and to help noobs and stuff like that. So that's not a bad place. And I, you know, gave them, like, I don't know, $35 or whatever the membership fee is, and so I've got, like, lots and lots of different things that I can do, like, I guess, private messages and stuff like that. So that's where I am. If you're on there, you know, send me a ping or whatever people do on Linux questions, and that would be great. And I think that's the end of the show.
I'm so tired. I gotta go to sleep.